Hello and welcome back to Radio Verulam 92.6 FM with me, Jason McKenna. Today we are beginning an important series of shows on discrimination in the UK. And I feel a great privilege in welcoming on Professor Hakeem Addy. Professor Addy is a British historian and scholar who specialises in African affairs. He has had an amazing career, with one of the highlights being his 2018 book, Pan-Africanism, A History. He currently lectures in the history of Africa and African diaspora at Chichester, West Sussex University. And today we are lucky to welcome on somebody who has an incredible knowledge on the subject we are discussing. Before we get into the discussions though, Professor Addy, how have you been coping in the current situation? How has COVID-19 affected your ability to research and write?
Obviously, I can't go to archives at the moment, places like the British Library or the National Archives. And also, during lockdown, it's very difficult to get material on interlibrary loan. So you become more reliant on those resources which are on the internet. But other than that, my teaching is more or less the same. Most of my teaching is online anyway, so I'm surviving.
Well, Professor Addy, it's fantastic to hear that you still are doing well in the current circumstances and also that you've still got this ability to research, even if it is in a slightly different capacity, to bring us the most up-to-date knowledge on a subject that I've written down here is almost an untold history of Britain. In fact, Professor Addy, I actually want to springboard off of one of your comments because you explained yourself in the openings of Black History, New Perspectives, that unfortunately, the history of African and Caribbean people in Britain, which stretches back over two millennia, is still a hidden history to a large extent. Could you please explain and open this out why an almost ancient history of Black British people remains hidden?
The history of Africans in Britain goes back about 2,000 years, something like that, certainly to Roman times, although it's likely that Africans were here possibly 1,000 years before that. And if we go back 10,000 years, we come across people like Cheddar Man with his dark skin and dark hair and blue eyes, who didn't come directly from Africa, but his ancestors would have come from Africa. So the known presence of Africans here, that we can demonstrate that Africans were here nearly 2,000 years ago in Roman times, and that included identified individuals like the famous ivory bangle lady who was buried in the city of York, and people like the Roman emperor Septimius Severus, who came from Libya, and many, many others. So it's a very, very long history that, in a way, hasn't been fully excavated or fully studied. And as the kind of recent analysis of the skeleton of Cheddar Man has shown, once the most modern scientific techniques are used on archaeological sites, archaeological remains, we may get very, very different history, or we may get more of this history than we have at the present time. But it's a lengthy history. It's not one that began in 1948.
Getting prepared for this interview today, Professor Addy, this is something that seems to come out with a lot of the research, that in certain areas and within certain historical communities, there is a reluctance to kind of give value to what is an honest and truthful area of British history. There's almost a disconnect and an uneasiness to actually approve and embrace this area of British history. Why is there a problem with some individuals to bring this honest part of history into the history of our country?
Well, I think, one only has to look at as you say, recent history, and there are many examples of, the most obvious example of those in government who openly proposed a history curriculum for schools, which was essentially about the white men of property. So it excluded people from Africa, people from Asia, it excluded women, it excluded workers, it included, So you have that, you have extremists, we can call them, who take that view and want to kind of distort history, who criticizes people, he says, are rewriting history. He means those who are challenging the establishment view of the history of Britain. So that is the kind of weight that we are pushing against, as it were. And it's the same people who, you know, glorify those who committed crimes against humanity, who were colonial invaders and plunderers and so on. So there's this kind of weight of whatever you want to call it, of tradition, of Eurocentrism, of excluding people from history, of writing a very, or presenting a very narrow view of history, which kind of favors the white men of property. And it's necessary to kind of smash that view of history, that presentation of history. And clearly that takes time. It's something that you would, you could say most people are open to and favorable to, but it just takes time to break it down. And every time there's an advance, if I think about my engagement with the national curriculum in schools, you make an advance 1 minute, then the government changes or the minister changes or something changes, and you're almost back to square one again. So it's pushing against that weight of, it's like pushing against the old to create the new, and the old is, you know, more powerful, has more resources, has, but it needs to be consigned to history, if that's not an irony, and a new history which just tells things as they are, that most people in Britain are immigrants, including Cheddar Man. Cheddar Man is the most ancient Briton we're aware of, was an immigrant. You know, the Saxons were immigrants, the Angles were immigrants, the Romans were immigrants, the Normans were immigrants, the Huguenots, the Irish, everybody's an immigrant, or the descendants of immigrants. There's nothing, this is just the way it is. It's nothing wrong in people knowing that history, or knowing that the vast majority of people in history are not white men of property. You know, that shouldn't be a secret. We all know that. So why try and say that we should have a history which only relates to them? No, we want a history which includes working people, includes women, and it includes African people, Caribbean history, Caribbean people, and everybody else.
What you've explained there, Professor Addy, is a fairer but more factual history of our country. And when I look at this situation, that discussions within certain circles, it seems comparable to the reclassification of Pluto as a planet. We have identified as something wrong with the way that history is being taught. It needs updating, the textbooks, the way that the message is conveyed. So why is it seen different that a reevaluation of British history based on fact is problematic? It seems almost a backlash against the truth, especially that these people were Britons as much as anybody else.
Well, I think that there are various vested interests in presenting a view of the world. It's really, history is not to say our understanding of the planetary system is not also a worldview, but maybe history is a more immediately important worldview. And I think that the powers that be have a particular view of, to try and present a particular view of the world, which is also inaccurate and false in relation to what goes on today, or what went on yesterday or what went on last week and so on. And so history is bound up, the presentation of history is bound up with that worldview. And we've seen the government act to back up their interventions on over the question of statues, for example. You know, the statues shouldn't be removed. That even if a museum wants to remove a statue or wants to place it somewhere, the government said no, nothing could be. So what? Yes, why? Why is the government suddenly so interested in statues? I mean, but I think the important point is that public opinion wants statues of some criminals to be removed. Of course, they could be put in a special museum of crimes against humanity or something, but the government is opposed to this. And you could say it's up to the government to explain why they're so in favor of publicly displaying criminals. If they have an argument, they don't present an argument. They just hang on to this particular view of history. But, you know, we can draw our own inferences, because what it amounts to is the continuation of the glorification of certain types of history. And the history of human trafficking, of slavery, the history of colonialism and so on, which the same politicians are always, either defending in terms of colonialism or trying to minimize it in the context of or in connection with enslavement and so on. And that relates to a whole lot of other issues of reparation and reparatory justice, a whole range of political questions, which clearly the powers that be don't want to give way on. The other thing which is important, as I said, of this question of worldview, it's very, very important how we see the world, and particularly how young people see the world, because history is not just a study of the past, but the ability to understand the present and our place in it. You know, the fact that we are the makers of history, that history is not about the deeds of the white men of property, but about the deeds of everybody else, generally speaking. And the powers that be do not want that view of the world, that view of history to, in my view, to become, to be presented or to be accepted. They want to impose their view of the world, I would say.
Continuing this analysis of problematic histories and maybe not portraying the truth or analysing it enough, early British Africans were not in a life of servitude as it is often portrayed and presented in these meta-narratives. There was a Roman emperor, princes, princesses. There were plenty of merchants or individuals that did well for themselves and were free individuals. So what was life like in that early period for Black Britons?
Well, it's difficult for me to say exactly, but I mean, Septimius Severus was the emperor of Rome, emperor of Britain, emperor of Rome. So you'd imagine he had a fairly good life, as it were, compared to the majority of people in Britain at that time. I think the important point is the point that you made, that these were not people in servitude or people who were brought as enslaved people. They were very often people of high status, of importance, and so on. The ivory bangle lady in York, again, one of the key things about her is that, again, she was a woman of high status, a young woman, buried with her jewelry. We don't know much about her and her life in detail, but that alone, that we have young people here from Africa, some of them would have come as young people. Some of them may even have been, others may even have been born here. And that tells us that, well, there were not just African soldiers here, but there were African men, women, and children. What were they doing here? We don't really know yet. But it just presents a different picture of Roman Britain. But okay, Roman Britain wasn't predominantly African, but it was, if you like, diverse enough that there were Africans here. And it should make us think a little bit differently about the world, and most particularly about the role of Africans in it, because one of the other problems of this history is not just the role of Africans in Britain or the status of Africans in Britain, in a way that's a kind of reflection of the way that Africa and African history is seen generally. And we're still dealing with the legacy of those who said Africa has no history. And that legacy isn't very far off. So what this helps us to see is that, okay, 2,000 years ago, the world was a very different place. You know, people came in from other parts of the world, they contributed and so on. And not just in the Roman period, if we go on to the Anglo-Saxon period, you find other people like Hadrian, who came here in the 7th century, as from North Africa, probably from Libya. Another important person was proposed as Archbishop of Canterbury, which he turned down, but he came here and then played a major role in the restructuring of the church, of the development of Anglo-Saxon literature, brought scholarly books with him from North Africa and so on. So again, this is just an individual that we happen to know about. There may well have been others, but it's just a part of history. What, you know, why shouldn't we know that there was some guy from North Africa who did these things? You could say, well, what's the big deal? Well, it isn't really a big deal in some ways, but it's only a big deal if it's obscured and people are told, no, Africans never did anything, or Africans weren't here, or whatever. No, let's just have it the truth as it is. And we, you know, we draw all the appropriate conclusions from knowing that, that truthful history.
I would say it is truly fascinating reading about the African empires that aren't often discussed when we talk about history. But unfortunately, we do have to move on to a shameful period of history. We have to shift our focus onto the slave trade. This came about in the country in the 1500s, but it was turned really into a proper business over the course of the next century. Historian Peter Fryer, in his seminal work, Staying Power, The History of Black People in Britain, explains Winthrop D. Jordan's argument that prejudice and slavery may well have been cause and effect on one another. What are the three-pronged origins of racism then, Professor Addy, that is explained in this book? The oral tradition of the other, economic utility, and also incredibly harmful pseudoscience.
Okay, well, let me answer it in this way. I think the important thing is that, you know, racism as we understand it today is mainly a consequence of human trafficking and slavery. I think that's the main point to get across, that it was something which, you know, developed as a justification, an explanation for the enslavement of some peoples, particularly Africans, in a period when in Europe people were beginning to question the servitude of everybody, you know, because we have the period of the Enlightenment, the rights of man, meaning human rights. And so if you're going to, in that context, in that period, if you're going to enslave some people, then you have to have an explanation or justification for it. So racism generally arose in that context. And it's not surprising that we find the main developers of this, of these ideas, these theories, being some of the major philosophers. So people like John Locke and David Hume and so on, whatever their other characteristics that may be, you know, magnificent, they certainly made a contribution to the development of modern racism with their ideas on Africans and so on, which frankly were dishonest, because, you know, the medieval world knew quite well as did the Tudor world, that, you know, Europeans went to Africa. They didn't go to Africa because it was poor. They didn't go to Africa because it was barbaric. They went to Africa because they knew that Africa had those things which they didn't have. And the two main things that Africa had that Europe didn't have was gold and spices, you could say, to put it simply. So the idea that, you know, Europe went to Africa because it was backward is just complete nonsense. So these philosophers knew, or could have found out if they'd been bothered, the history of Africa, but they developed a different narrative because it served their interests and the interests of others who they were connected with. So I think that's the point. Having said that, racism draws on all kinds of myths and superstitions as well. It obviously has to have some ammunition to use. So the point that Peter Fryers makes is he tries to explain some of these things, like color symbolism, ideas of black being bad and white being good and so on. So racism can draw on some of these notions, but in a way they were kind of minor things. And what was important were the ideas of African inferiority and so on and so forth. And it's important to recognize, and one of the important things that Peter Fryer does in his book, as well as others have done, is to show that these ideas of African inferiority and so on are not dissimilar to other forms of racism, such as anti-Irish racism, for example, where you also get the idea the Irish are primitive and stupid and barbaric and all these kinds of things. And there are other forms of racism within Europe. But of course, the racism developed against Africans in many ways more pervasive, perhaps more serious, although some of us are old enough to remember the kind of anti-Irish racism that existed in this country in the 1970s, 1980s, and so on and so forth. So that's the first thing. And then the other is that as ideas developed, and as modern science developed, there began to be developed various theories which, although they were presented as scientific, were not scientific, were anti-scientific or pseudo-scientific, which were used to back up these earlier ideas of African inferiority and so on. So these are the kind of things of people measuring heads and skulls and claiming that, you know, men have bigger skulls than women, therefore men are more intelligent and all these kind of nonsense. So the fact that it's applied, can be applied to women, or it can be applied to different, the idea of different races of human beings. And what Peter Fryer does is to show that these different races of human beings were not only Africans, Asians, Europeans, etc., but also the rich, the poor, all were considered different races, the Irish, the whatever it was. So all this is nonsense, but these kind of ideas also fed into this racist narrative, these ideologies of racism. That, okay, well, yes, people have different shaped heads and different this and that. This proves that some are inferior to others and some are good at this and some are, and all these kinds of ideas. So, but what lay behind all these, the concoction of these ideas was the enslavement of Africans, the colonial conquest of Africa at the end of the 19th century and so on and so forth. And then these ideas become, you could say, institutionalized in the society. So that in Britain in the early 20th century, you have a color bar, which effectively means if you are a person of color, you are barred from joining the army, for example, or if you can join, being an officer in the army, or competing for a boxing title, or being served in a pub, all based on the idea that, well, if you're a black person or a person of colour, to use a modern phrase, you're somehow inferior, you're to be shunned, ignored, segregated in some way, you're a lesser human being, and so on. And these ideas are stoked, are fueled by cartoons, by children's books, by sermons in the pulpit, by film, by radio, by any means you can think of, because they become the kind of dominant ideas of society, because they support the idea of empire, that we British are superior to everybody. And that is why we're ruling Africa, that's why we're ruling Asia, that's why we're whatever. So this feeds into the kind of national psyche almost. It becomes part of society. And as we know today, it becomes very, very difficult to get rid of it, even though slavery is gone, colonialism has gone, more or less. These ideas, you know, still persist. And of course, they're then reinforced by... So anyway, that's the kind of, I think, the kind of history that Peter Fryer and others are trying to present.
I actually want to draw out this discussion a little bit further, because this actually links to my next point, that although the abolition of the slave trade in Britain was in 1807, this was not the beginning of a new positive era of race relations between black and white people in the country. Indeed, the enslavement of the individual was now frowned upon, but the subjugation of nations was very much allowed and was actually growing with the colonialism of the empire. What was the shift in ideology that allowed for one but not the other in the eyes of the English, Professor Addy?
Well, I'm not sure it's good to look at it as a shift in ideology as such, but what we have is that what we have to remember firstly was that Britain was the world's leading human trafficker. So then the question arises, okay, if that was the case, why did Britain then stop being the world's leading human trafficker? What changed? And I think there are two things that changed. One is that the struggles of Africans in the colonies to liberate themselves took off in a very major way, particularly with the revolution in Haiti, which threw the whole slave system into crisis. And that's one thing. The other thing is that the struggles of, you know, working people in this country in opposition to human trafficking and so on was also a factor. But what that meant is it became increasingly hazardous for Britain to engage in importing more potential revolutionaries into the Caribbean. And secondly, there was the calculation that if Britain stopped importing more revolutionaries or potential revolutionaries, it had more enslaved Africans in its colonies than any of its competitors, and that its navy was strong enough as a result of the Napoleonic Wars to make sure that nobody else could import any more Africans into their colonies. So it was an economic calculation with a political calculation which led to the end of human trafficking for British citizens. And then Britain used its navy to interfere in everybody else's business. So all its rivals, whether it's the French, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the US, and so on. So that, you could say, gave Britain a kind of military, a political, and economic advantage. Slavery didn't come to an end, but the importation of enslaved Africans was brought to an end. I mean, there are other reasons to do with economics and the production of the relative strengths of the rulers in Britain, whereas in the 18th century it was the slave owners who were dominant or more dominant. In the 19th century, it was the industrialists and others who needed different things, and sugar wasn't particularly one of them, but there were other things that they needed. So there are all these kinds of changes, which I think are important to bear in mind, rather than looking at it from the point of view of, you know, wasn't the mother of parliaments wonderful that they suddenly came to this conclusion and it's all about William Wilberforce and others and so on. I don't think that was quite as simple as that. The other thing to point out is that, you know, you couldn't say that the position of Africans necessarily improved. You couldn't even say that necessarily that human trafficking came to an end either, because there are lots of examples of where it didn't. And certainly slavery didn't come to an end. And you couldn't say either that the position of working people in Britain improved, because the struggles for the rights of working people in Britain, you know, really took off in the 19th century and were often connected with the struggles of Africans in the colonies to liberate themselves, that people saw a connection between the two very often. So, you know, that was the kind of changes that took place in the 19th century. They're perhaps more complex than, you know, we often think. And then the other thing to mention is that the struggles against human trafficking in the 18th century were also enormous. Some of the biggest political campaigns in Britain's history in the 1780s, 1790s. So that's also very important. When we think of this hidden history of Britain, the fact that nobody ever celebrates these massive campaigns which involve workers and women and people refusing to drink sugar and petitioning of parliament, and these are enormous things, but barely ever mentioned.
Was another reason, though, that the slave trade in England was abandoned because it caused all sorts of legal problems and loopholes that weren't foreseen previously. On the colonies, it was justified and still allowed because these deplorable acts were being taken outside of the realm of the island of Britain. This was seen as almost okay. But the problem was when it was in England, it was going against a lot of the laws and the legislations that were against the freedom of the individual.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, the law was ambiguous. And the law essentially applied to the colonies. In other words, slavery was legal in the colonies. If you were in Jamaica, slavery was legal. Or if you were in North America, slavery was legal. But the question was it actually legal in Britain? And that was quite a complex question. And there were sort of political reasons why it wasn't acceptable, generally speaking, to have a law in Britain which categorically stated that slavery existed. So what happened was that those who were slave owners brought their enslaved Africans to Britain and held them as slaves, as if the law permitted it. But what then happened was that the Africans, with the help of their British allies, liberated themselves, ran away, absconded, organized themselves in various ways throughout the 18th century, claiming essentially that, okay, well, we don't accept the status of slavery. And they did other things, you know, people got themselves baptized, they, you know, on occasions got married, or anyway, various things to demonstrate that they were not heathens, because there were, you know, there were certain legal judgments that seem to suggest if you were not a Christian, you could be held in slavery. So people say, okay, I'm a Christian. Or anyway, so this went on throughout the 18th century. These court cases, these contestations, people liberating themselves, running away, and so on. And the court cases went on to such a degree that, and then they started to involve the burgeoning abolitionist movement. And people started to write about these things, you know, Granville Sharp and others. And the law had to kind of make a judgment. And the judgment which the law made, or the Lord Chief Justice made in the 1770s, was that it wasn't not to say that slavery was illegal, but to say that it was illegal for somebody who to be taken out of the country essentially against their will. So somebody who'd liberated themselves could not then be re-kidnapped and taken out of the country as a slave. So all that that did was to give succor, if you like, to those who were liberating themselves, and showed that the law was unable to enforce, that there was no law which said people could be held as slaves in this country. However, it didn't bring slave status to an end. There were still cases after that. People were still held, and we know that in the 1830s, people like Mary Prince were still held in bondage in this country. But what it again shows is that there was a general opposition in the country amongst most ordinary people were opposed to other human beings being held in this way. And the slave owners were kind of on the back foot, trying to, you know, kind of resist this sentiment, as it were. And as I said, the most advanced political forces recognized the identity of interest between Africans, the liberation of Africans, and the liberation, or the political liberation of workers in Britain. So you have organizations like the London Corresponding Society. That was their principle. If you're for the rights of Africans, then you're for the rights of the working people in Britain. If you're for the rights of the working people in Britain, then you're also for the rights of Africans. So this idea of fighting for the rights of all, which is a very modern political concept, a very enlightened one, people had this idea in the 18th century too.
Yes, there does seem to be quite a few stories from the era that people can actually be proud of. Historical efforts from towns and communities coming together, I think during the American War of Independence, when the cotton trade had come to a halt, a lot of these people stood together and said, we will not continue in this terrible trade as long as slavery is involved. These are moments that could be explored more and can be seen as moments of positivity during a negative situation. Why aren't these explored more?
Yeah, exactly right. Yes, I think you're referring to the period of the American Civil War rather than the War of Independence. Yes, and there are all these examples of weavers in Lancashire and so on acting in this way. Just as I mentioned, people protested in the 18th century. The protests continued in the 19th century, and there are the examples that you gave. So there are these traditions of working people in this country. And in fact, the anti-slavery movement in the 19th century was also very large and broad and so on. But these are traditions which are not celebrated, perhaps not even taught, generally not known about. Just as there are people who stood up against, you know, later on the British invasion of the Sudan, for example. There are those who stood up and protested. So there are all of these traditions against slavery, against colonialism, which are hidden for some reason. And, you know, we are not taught them, or our young people are not taught these things. And that's to be deplored and something that needs to be changed.
Bringing it back to somebody that you did mention a little bit earlier, William Wilberforce, he is described as the great emancipator, and he worked alongside some others to remove slavery during the period. But why were these discussions held there? Why didn't total equality come at this time of enlightenment and the growth of scientific thinking?
Yeah, it wasn't. There wasn't great equality in Britain. So there's not going to be great equality in the colonies, which were money-making estates. The other thing is about these reformers, no doubt, William Wilberforce played his role, but, the most important abolitionist act in that period was the revolution in Haiti, which also had great support in Britain, not least because it was a war, although it was also a revolution against the British army, it was even more importantly a revolution against the French army. So it was, and the Spanish for that matter. So it was supported, but one person who didn't support it was William Wilberforce. So William Wilberforce, who, worked closely with the political establishment, the Prime Minister, William Pitt and others, they had their interests, their calculations and their, which were not necessarily the same as those who have the enslaved who were prepared to liberate themselves by force and so on. So the point being that individuals like William Wilberforce undoubtedly played a role in all of this. But in history, it's not just individuals and the white men of property who are important, but the masses of the people, both in this country, who campaigned, who gave up sugar, who signed petitions, who lobbied parliament, who demonstrated, and even more importantly, those Africans who fought to liberate themselves, gave their lives in Haiti, as well as in other islands, in Jamaica, in Barbados, in what is today Guyana, and many other places, who rose up over many years and made the whole slave system very, very difficult to enforce. The other thing, of course, about British history is important to say is those Africans who were in Britain at the time, who also played their role, not just by liberating themselves, but by their writing. So people like Equiano, Corguano, and others who formed themselves into the Sons of Africa, they also played an important role in this general abolitionist campaign, by providing an African voice, by countering the views of the racists and so on. So we should understand their importance, not just as, literate Africans who wrote, but as part of this broad campaign, which sure, William Wilberforce was also part of, but so were hundreds of thousands of other people.
This is one of the most interesting things about the stories to do with Britain and its past and the profound changes that we saw. It was to do with huge movements at the top, but also, often, pressures and big change came from the little people as well. And these aren't as explored as explained. But let's move on the appraisal to more of the modern British history and race relations, because the hegemonic history of the nation is often in Britain that people feel proud of the way racism is perceived to have been handled. Often when discussing history, people feel that the past of this country is not as stained as others. Indeed, the United States of America is often the country that is cited, and Britons feel that we've done much better than that country. But David Olusoga has described how the separation of the Industrial Revolution and black history is the moral blind spot of Victorian history. The focus on the triumph of the former needs to be discussed with the latter, as it is unjust to do so. How much is modern Britain's history actually overlooking real history where black voices have been marginalised?
I think it's difficult to explain the Industrial Revolution without explaining human trafficking and enslavement and empire. That's really the point, that the wealth which fueled the Industrial Revolution, the banking system, the insurance system, everything else in Britain was dependent on the exploitation of African, or the exploitation of Asians as well. But it must also be said, it was also based on the exploitation of people in Britain. So the issue is to present this history in its entirety. You don't want to say it was just based on the enslavement of Africans without talking about the enslavement exploitation of people in Asia. But then you don't want to say it was only based on the exploitation of Asia and Africa, not also on the exploitation of people in Britain, because there otherwise you get a one-sided presentation of things. But the problem is that, generally speaking, it's been presented as a kind of miracle, you know, as a kind of Anglo-Saxon miracle, which doesn't help anybody understand anything, and is just a kind of chauvinist presentation of things without actually explaining how these, you know, what actually occurred. Where did this wealth come from? It really comes down to the question of how is wealth produced and who are the wealth producers? And of course, this is a question which is great confusion about, not even confusion, disinformation about, because the powers that be present it that, you know, it's whatever, it's people sitting in the stock exchange or wherever they sit that actually produce wealth. Well, of course they don't. And, you know, wealth is only produced by, you know, human labor, by people producing things. So once you accept that, you know, wealth in society is produced by those who labor, then you find, okay, well, who are the laborers? And then everything becomes perfectly clear. But if you deny that, then you're kind of searching for miracles, and you want to eliminate all the people who created the wealth, which is basically how history is presented. You know, that it's somehow, you know, it's all about inventions and it's about James Watt. And as we know, you know, James Watt was also involved in exploitation of Africans and so on. But even if he hadn't have been, that wouldn't change the basic fuel of the Industrial Revolution, which is the exploitation of labor in Britain, Africa, Asia, and elsewhere.
Moving a little further through British history, we enter the 20th century, and the general narratives of the era actually overlook many of the problems at the time. There are tales of national unity, especially in regards to World War I and II, but that was only for some. The colour bar experienced by many black Britons, including many war heroes who had fought on Flanders fields and also in the battles of World War II, was very real indeed. The post-World War I colour bar was very similar to the racism that the civil rights movement rallied against in America at the same time. There was even lynch mobs appearing off the country during times of heightened racism. Could you tell us about these unsavory periods?
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that the First World War itself grows out of the scramble for colonies and the redivision of the world, which had occurred in Africa and other parts of the world. So we shouldn't lose sight of that, because the powers that be that present the First World War was all about, you know, looking after poor little Belgium. Belgium, or the King of Belgium, had just slaughtered, you know, 8 million Africans. So the First World War is not about looking after poor little Belgium, and that's complete nonsense. So, yes, and then we come to, the period of the First World War, there is a colour bar. So there's a colour bar in the armed forces, and that's why we celebrate people like Walter Tull, because he managed to break through that colour bar. And he's not actually exceptional. There were others, but that's their claim to fame, that they overcame this colour bar which existed. Then, as you say, after the war, the racism was definitely promoted by both by government and by the leaders of certain trade unions, particularly the National Union of Seamen, or what became the National Union of Seamen, to create divisions in the interests of the ship owners as well as others. And so you get these racist attacks or riots in nine towns and cities throughout Britain in 1919. And then you get the introduction of various laws, the Aliens Act of the same year, the Coloured Alien Seamen's Order 1925, the British Shipping Assistance Act 1935, which all are openly racist laws discriminating against African, Caribbean, and other coloured, as the term at the time, seafarers, and creating these divisions and actual attacks on people, unequal working conditions, unequal pay. This goes on throughout the 1920s, 1930s, even 1940s. And as you said, again, when we come to the Second World War, again, people volunteer for the armed forces from Africa, from the Caribbean, as well as those people of African and Caribbean heritage in Britain. And again, there is a color bar. And it's only with great reluctance that the armed forces admit people. And there are some auxiliary services, the land army, for example, which openly discriminates against black British citizens. So all of that is in existence during this period of the first 40, 45 years, even though the Second World War ostensibly fought against fascism and the racial notions of fascism, these problems existed in Britain at the time. And I mean, one of the things which stands out about this period up to the 1960s is the continual refusal of government to make any laws outlawing racism or discrimination in public places, in employment, in housing, anything else. So again, when you look at the way that racism operates, it's the powers that be, the government, that play the major role in all of this, as well as others. And union leaders often played a key role. But this is where these problems stem from and are kind of perpetuated over and over again. And to the detriment not only of black people, but to other workers, to all workers, because divisions are created, wages of one section of the workforce are lowered, and therefore that's used as a way of lowering the wages of everybody and the conditions of everybody. And the trade unions, rather than organizing everybody, actually worked hand in glove with the employers, as I say, to the detriment of everybody. So this is the kind of history of these things, which, you know, has led to, even in the 1919, led to deaths, and has led to deaths, you know, throughout the 20th century and even in the 21st century. And the idea that the inequality of citizens, that some citizens are better than others, are more important, and others are, you know, some are superior, some are inferior, which is what, again, we have with the so-called Windrush scandal and with all these immigration acts, nationality acts, they're all openly racist. And then when some people are victimized, then government turns around in amazement. So how is this possible? Well, it's quite obvious, because you have racist immigration laws, nationality acts, and they're put into operation with clear intent to discriminate against people. So anyway, that's, you know, how racism has sort of manifested itself over the last century. And it's good to see this year again, people from, you know, Land's End to John O'Groats voicing their displeasure and disapproval and wanting the new again, wanting a new world, a new society where these things don't happen and not perpetuated all the time. And that's, it's in that context, it's like where we started, it's in that context that the powers that be stand against all this. It's like a whole history that we've looked at. You see these two things, this struggle going on, the people who want change all the time, everybody should be treated the same, no racism, no slavery, no colonialism. And then on the other hand, you have those who say, no, everything's fine. We're doing just fine, thanks. Let's have more inequality. Let's not do anything.
Well, Professor Addy, we've started to touch upon the 20th century there, but unfortunately, that's all that we've got time for today. We will be discussing the 20th century and the 21st century, and also how all this applies to present-day Britain in the next episode. So make sure to stay tuned to that. We will be posting that very, very soon. But in terms of it, Professor Addy, I just have to thank you for your time today. It has been so insightful to talk to you about this history.
You're welcome anytime.